listening to another Netcast production brought to you by the Fancy Pants Gangsters at fancypantsgangsters.com. Because those who can, do. Those who cannot, do it on the internet. Hey everyone, it's Evan from fancypantsgangsters.com and the Film Army. We're doing our old opening now for a very specific reason. This is kind of a goofy show right now. May has not been kind to the Film Army. We've had a lot of movings, a couple job changes, a couple vacations. It's been a fun month, by and large, and I think the majority of us are still even kind of hungover from Memorial Day. So we're doing a slightly different show. We're not doing like a full show like we normally do. But I didn't want to give you nothing. So what we're going to do something a little more abbreviated, a little more loosey-goosey, I guess. What we're going to do, we've got a couple cool features for you. We do have a long-awaited feature from Jeff on his slobs versus snobs genre that we've been putting out for a couple months. We've also got a really cool interview that Mike does from yet another gaming show. He joined us, and he did a great interview with Sarah Douglas, who you might remember from Superman 1 and 2, despite the fact that Mike calls it something slightly different. And we've also got outtakes of last month's episode. We got a couple clips from Tom Brazelton from theaterhopper.com, guest of ours on the War Room last month. We've also got some outtakes from the interview I did with Cole Kohler from Snack Attack Samurai. We talk a little bit about commercials and kind of his writing process and all that stuff. So all of that is going to be in this show. And finally, we'll be wrapping up this month's episode of the Film Army with another installment of Box Office Poison. This week, Nate is taking a look at Ballistic X versus Sever, clearly one of Antonio Banderas' finest roles. Just to let you know, we are sponsored in part by Netflix, and you can get your two-week subscription for free to Netflix. Just go to bit.ly/fpgflix, and start your two-week trial free of charge, and that helps support the Film Army. We thank everyone that's already done it, and we're thanking everyone in advance that will do it. So without further ado, here's a little bit of a look at Slobs versus Snobs, courtesy of Film Army Rear Admiral Jeff, and I just want to thank you guys for listening, and I promise the show will be awesome in July.
This is Jeff, and I've got a segment right now called Typically Speaking. So I was watching the movie Out Cold a couple weeks ago, and I realized that I kind of like the structure of slobs versus snobs movies. For those of you who don't know, the movie Out Cold stars Zach Galifianakis, Jason London, and Lee Majors, and involves Lee Majors' resort company trying to take over the small-town ski resort all the slobs work at. This movie made me realize that nearly all slobs versus snobs movies have elements in common, and that's kind of what I like about them. The familiarity of the premise is a plus in my eyes. I also believe the slobs versus snobs archetype is more than just a poor, slobby person going against a rich person. To be a true slobs versus snobs movie, there has to be an element of rebellion against conformity, of fighting for something that you believe in because it's the right thing to do. Call it the lapsed punk in me, but I want to see the underdogs win and the corporate thugs lose. A return to a lost youth for a guy who's resigned himself to his day job in real life. But not just any movie about an underdog is a true slobs versus snobs movie in my eyes. It takes a special set of ingredients to make that winning formula.
Hey everybody, we're all gonna get laid!
So what are the common elements? Well, first, the slobs themselves. They're a group of misfits from different walks of life, united under the same banner. And mind you, I do mean a group. This isn't just one man fighting for what he believes in. This is a group, a community. Now, sometimes they are literal slobs, like the caddies in Caddyshack who smoke and litter and beat the crap out of each other. And sometimes they're just a group of people thrown together because of a shared situation, like the nerds in Revenge of the Nerds. They're not all literal nerds, just social misfits who band together because they're the oppressed.
Well, if I was you, I'd do something about it. I would get up and redeem myself in the eyes of my father, my maker, and my coach. Well, let's get those nerds!
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 What are we waiting for?
And now, the snobs. Now, much like the slobs, they don't need to be particularly snobbish. What they are is uniform. They represent conformance. They are subscribing to an ideal that is different from the slobs, and they believe the slobs are getting in the way. Call them the Nazis of the movie world, at least, outside of World War II movies. The snobs are the jocks to the revenging nerds, the Omegas to the Animal House Deltas, and the Edina Cake Ears to the scrappy South Minneapolis Mighty Ducks. By the way, one of my favorite movies as a kid. God, I love the Mighty Ducks. And the fact that it was filmed and set in and around Minneapolis makes me happy as an adult. Those Edina Cake Eaters really are jerks.
Is that your address?
Yes.
Well, then I'm afraid there's no mistake. This boy is playing for the wrong team.
What?
According to league rules, Adam Banks should be playing for District 5.
My son is a hawk, not a duck.
Is this your doing, Gordon?
I'll expect to see him at our next...
Well, you know you make me wanna kick my heels up and down.
Now, this part isn't in every slobs versus snobs movie, but it's in the good ones. It's the betrayal. The snobs try to convert one of the slobs and always fail. Oh yeah, maybe they manage to convert someone for a while, but you know, by the end of the movie, that guy's gonna be right back where he belongs, with the slobs. Caddyshack had Judge Smales trying to coerce Danny Noonan with promises of scholarships and high-class living. And yes, Danny is temporarily swayed. But all it takes is one devilishly handsome playboy to bring him back down to earth. The corollary to this rule, seen in a lot of college frat movies, is the slob trying to join the snob's clique and getting rejected. On the other side, the slobs too are working their version of the betrayal plot against the snobs. Lawyer Emilio Estevez uses zoning rules to force the Hawks' star player over to the Mighty Ducks. And you know what? It succeeds. It has to. They're the heroes, the good guys. They have to win. Corollary to this is the Romeo and Juliet variation, where one of the slobs convinces the hottest snob to cross the tracks for love. In Out Cold, Jason London lands the hot, sort of unidentifiably foreign daughter of Lee Majors.
We can do anything. Even take on Camp MVP, Apache Relay. And we can win.
And now, my favorite part, the climax. This is it. This is the end game. The chance for the slobs to show they're more than just scrubs. They're a team. Hell, they're a family. Now, there's two ways this can play out. First, it ends in some sort of contest, like in sports movies and summer camp movies. Or it ends in the ultimate prank, seen in a lot of college movies. The contest is always tied to the sport the movie is based around. I mean, Mighty Ducks had hockey, Caddyshack had golf, and Dodgeball had, right in the title. The team has learned everything they can, and they probably picked up a few ringers along the way. And you know what? They're ready to fight it to the end. In summer camp movies of this form, we usually have some sort of skills contest, like a multi-part thing. The best way to do this is to have three events. One that the slobs will obviously win, one that the snobs will obviously win, and one that could go either way. I mean, that's just good dramatic tension. On the other side, we've got the ultimate prank. The slobs realize they can't beat the snobs on their own turf, so they take whatever chance they can get. Out Cold showed us the former resort workers doing tricks off conveniently placed snowbanks during Lee Major's unveiling ceremony to the investors. And Animal House had John Belushi stealing a homecoming parade float and driving into a life of public service.
Okay,
cut the shit. All right, we got our work cut out for us. Tomorrow is the big 500th Summer Olympic can, and we got to figure out how we're going to beat those rich snobs from the fat kids camp.
Even better than a good slobs versus snobs movie is the parodies. It's such a well-known formula and one that's ripe for parody. Mr. Show did a great sketch where Buddhist monks were the slobs to the fat kids camp across the lake from their temple. I mean, South Park devoted a whole episode a few years back to the boys going to Aspen, Colorado and getting involved in a fight over a local rec center. And in my research for this article, which actually mostly involved watching Heavyweights, I came upon a great Onion article called Scrappy Band of Lovable Misfits, No Match for Rich Kids. And that's why I like these movies, because there's a shared language to them. You know what the story beats are, but that doesn't matter because it's fun to see the good guys win. And sometimes you need that pick-me-up that you can only get from punching a German camp counselor in the nuts.
So my name is Mike here with FancyPantsGangsters.com. I'm also here with Jay.
Hello, everybody.
Representing the Film Army. And we're here with Sarah Douglas right now here at SpringCon 2010. So hello, and thank you for doing an interview with us today.
My pleasure. I don't know who I'm speaking to, but I'm always delighted to basically speak to anybody.
So your biggest role is obviously been in Superman 1 and 2.
Let me just say that's not a good start, but it's all right. You're all right. I've been fed, so I'm not feeling too mean. Yeah, Superman 1 and 2, that's true.
So I had actually read that you had beaten out literally hundreds of other people in that. Could you talk to us about it all, the process of how that all went through and how you managed to...
Well, I was working on another picture at the time of the when they were casting. I was working on a film called The People at Time Forgot, mm-hmm. Which was a wonderful film with sort of cardboard dinosaurs and pterodactyls and things like that. A lot of fun, with an actor called Doug McClure and Patrick Wayne, son of John Wayne. And this is a few years back, and they were auditioning people for Superman. So I actually knew nothing about it. I was in the Canary Islands making this other picture. And I got wind of something going on in England. And when I got back, indeed, everybody was abuzz with the story of this role that was going. I knew nothing about Ursa. I knew nothing about it. I did know they were going to be making a big picture, and it was going to be starring with Marlon Brando. Of course, Chris Reeve was not known then, but Marlon Brando, certainly Gene Hackman, were names to conjure with. So I was happy to be part of the audition process, except because I was filming, I was never available in the daytime, and everybody else went over to the other studio in the daytime, and I was always filming. And 8 separate times, we had an appointment for me to meet in the evening with the producers, and 8 separate times they cancelled me, or I would go over to the studio and something would happen. So I got, by the 8th time, I was in a really pissy, nasty, unpleasant mood. And I was tired and cranky, and I was filming something else, and I wasn't that bothered. I really wasn't. I didn't understand what I was getting into. I just thought that this is getting to be a real pain in the butt. So the 8th time, the casting director phoned me, and she said, you know what, this role is absolutely made for you. You've really got to hang in and try and come in. So the 9th, I said, one more shot. The 9th time I went, I drove to the other studio from the studio, 7 o'clock in the evening, I had a long day, and that's the relevance of it. I'd been filming all day. And I got there, and they kept me waiting for about half an hour. And then this guy comes in with his blue-tinted, I always remember it, because I've never seen anybody in blue-tinted glasses before, and with his California tan, and this was Dick Donner, the director. Okay. And he came in, and I was in a pretty bad mood, and I let him have it. About, who do you think you are? Yeah, come over here from America, you know. and this is my 9th appointment, and you kept me waking half an hour, and it seems that he just went, whoa, yeah. Okay, so that was my initial meeting, and he was so impressed with my, I wouldn't say my foul mouth, because of course I don't have one, but my attitude. And that was the very start of the audition process. I then had to go two, three more times, and they culminated in my flying test, which we were then down to 3 actresses, and the third we had to fly. And I went in, and I'm very English, in Superman I'm wearing a wig. I had very long hair in those days, and I went over again in the evening. Because again, I wasn't, they'd screen tested actresses, but there is no screen test of me. And if anybody's seen on the making of Superman, they show some of the screen tests. I wasn't available for a screen test. The producers weren't about to pay for me to test in the evening and keep the crew on. So I just had to go over, and one of the things I had to do was the flying test. Anyway, I got over, and I was told that I had to go up on the wires, and I was dressed in a little black leotard, and I got my little plimsolls on, and I got my long hair tied back, and I was frightfully English. And they said, you're going to jump off that windowsill over there, and then we want you to fly to the other side of the room. And that's exactly what I did. But as I flew over the producers and directors, one of the crew looked up at me, and he shouted, "Here, darling, you've got no chance. The last bird flew without any panties on." This is absolutely true. The actress before me, it appears, had actually got up there on the wires with very... I hope you've got people listening that are of a certain age.
But, yes.
Without any,
we don't
without,
censor.
Yeah, no, without any underwear on. But I got the job, so hey, must have done something right.
That's amazing. That's a great story. You're actually the second Superman interview that we've done. We did Margot Kidder at... At Crypticon last fall. So she actually had a lot of good things to say about everybody, including yourself, as far as the process.
Yeah, we had a great time together. Yeah. Margot and I were great pals and still are. So it was fun. It was a long, tedious, long, drawn out process.
Sure, I imagine.
And a lot of days we didn't really do that much. So it was kind of tedious. You know, it sounds great, but it was 9 months and then 8 months, something like that. It was a lot of endless days, but the product was good.
And we also noticed that you just finished up, in preparation for the interview here, we kind of pulled up your IMDb page, and we noticed that you just finished up the video commentary for the special edition of, what was it,
Conan?
Yeah,
I did that. I actually did that some time ago, so they're a little bit out of touch. I did. Okay. What I have just finished, which is going to be on the Sci-Fi channel, which premieres next Saturday night, so that's May the 22nd. Witchville, which is this film here. I'm just showing you a photograph, which I play the Red Queen, and we shot this in China.
Okay.
I am playing yet again an evil wicked queen, but this time with a dead eagle on my head. More of the same. And also, which I've had fun doing, just last week I was doing the second episode of the interactive Doctor Who episodes, we've got the new Doctor Who airing, and this is going to be I don't know that we're going to get it in America yet. In England and Europe, it's going to be a free download of the game.
And I had actually heard about that.
Yeah, so I've done 2 episodes, although last week I'm a bit worried I played a blob-like entity. So I'm not thrilled with that character, blob-like entity, but the week before I was a professor, and I've got a little bit more to come up, so we'll see.
Oh, as long as they don't make you play a Cyberman or a Dalek,
I have a sneaky feeling that might be on the card. But it's fun to be part of it. I've done an audio for Doctor Who. I would love to get myself, on the series. Of course, I would. Exactly. So we'll see what happens. Thank you. We'll see what happens.
Now, are you a big sci-fi fan? Because we've also noticed that you've done stuff with Stargate. I mean, now you're doing the Doctor Who stuff.
You think I could actually sit here and say, no, I'm not? suffice to say, just don't ask me any questions about sci-fi. The first job I ever had was in a sci-fi movie, which was called... Here, I think it's called The
Last Days of Man on Earth here in the States. Okay. It was released with the
final program in England, The Last Days of Man on Earth. And that was Michael Moorcock was the writer, and that was my first job ever. And from then on, rollerball for Jewison. I mean, the early days I did small parts, but I just did it.
Sure.
The last two jobs I've done, I played pre-op transsexuals, so go figure. I'm an actress. But it just so happens that, yes, I love the genre and I have fun and I love fantasy and sci-fi. I most of the time have no idea what I'm talking about, but I carry it off because I have an English accent. People think I know what I'm doing.
Well, you do an amazing job.
Thank you.
Fantastic.
Thank you very much. Well, it's much appreciated. So this is just a nice opportunity to come and meet the fans, and I think it's really important for us to get out and say hello to people. It also keeps you. It means people will make that little bit of an effort to tune into something or to take a look at something. And
absolutely.
So it keeps the old girl alive.
Did you have another movie that you're really looking forward to this year? Is Iron Man pretty much going to be like, I can die after I see that movie?
Yeah, you know, I've been looking through IMDb, and I'm thinking, well, okay, if we're saying what, May until July?
Yeah, that's fine.
Yeah, I mean,
yeah, August is usually going to be the weakest part. So,
I'm looking forward to Predators, but I know it's not going to be good.
Mm-hmm.
Now, was Inception. That the Adrian Brody movie that was being shot in Iowa?
No.
No.
that was, boy, if only. If
if
all the vast jungles of Des Moines.
In that context, it's going to be shot in Wisconsin, I think.
Right. Yeah. We got some really rugged terrain out here. A lot of waterfalls.
Holy crap. I've never heard of this movie. Predators?
No?
How did they get
the
like,
hell
people
have you
with
been?
Names? I don't follow the news.
They got Robert Rodriguez. That's how they got names.
Well, actually, he's just producing. It's like one of those brought to you by Quentin Tarantino movies. Like who's the name? Nimrod.
Yeah, Nimrod on Tall.
What did he direct? He did direct something that I think I liked, and I can't.
Yeah,
remember
and of course now I can't think of it either.
Let me look.
To the internet.
He did Armored. That wasn't it.
No, no one liked that.
Which was pretty good.
For what? Oh, he did Control, and yes. He did Vacancy. I think that was what people remember for. So pretty much nothing anyone saw.
Yeah. Well, that's it's gonna be. You know what it's gonna be. You got Rodriguez producing, and then you got Nimrod directing. It's pretty much gonna be like a Peter Jackson, kind of sitting over your shoulder thing. Where it's like, dude, maybe if you did it like this.
Yeah.
Like it'll be District 9, probably.
There are worse things to be.
True.
That's
but yeah, besides Iron Man and Predators, just from a fan standpoint, I love the mythology, and I'm waiting for another movie to get it right. That's the thing. Like, in Predators 2, I don't know, spoiler alert, but when Danny Glover's on the ship,
yes.
You guys will see. Yeah, okay.
And he says, I'm too old for this shit.
And then he goes, wah, no. But they have that bleached alien skull in the trophy room. There has not been a movie yet that has delivered on that promise. And you know what I mean?
I stand by my support of the second Alien versus Predator. Not because of any sort of faithfulness to the mythology. And I'm like you, Tom, where I'm a big fan of that. Of that whole backstory and that. But I enjoyed Alien versus Predator 2 quite a bit.
I liked it when they blew up the heads of those two hippies.
And that's always good time.
Yeah, that was good.
Yeah.
Like, hey, man, we got to get out of here. There's like Shaggy just getting like... head gone. But, that's the thing I don't understand. Why Fox is like the movie studio that will snatch, defeat out of the jaws of victory. They will... You have two awesome franchises... Take some aliens, take some predators, take some space marines, make $1 trillion. That's all you have to do. And no, let's put it in like suburban Washington. That's a good place for this film with like no name actors. And the less said, the better.
But, do you think Fox? I think Fox just has this history of having great sci-fi
franchises and then not supporting them at all. I mean, you can look at Aliens and Predators. You can also look at Firefly if you go to the TV side of it.
Yep. Oh, yeah. Well, and Fox's television legacy. I mean, gosh. Yeah,
let's reopen that one, please.
Yeah.
Yeah. Arrested Development, anyone? I mean, Arrested Development, Dollhouse. I'm amazed that Fringe is still on at all. Like, wow. They're actually letting
that one
breathe.
That's because Joshua Jackson still has a bunch of cred from Dawson's Creek that he's still he's burning through. So.
And Mighty Ducks.
And Mighty Ducks. Shot in Minneapolis. There he is.
He's got that Dawson cred.
Yes.
You know, it's funny. Like, people will write me and they're like, what do you have against Shia LaBeouf? I'm like, did you see Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull? Granted, there's a lot of things wrong with that movie, and not all of it is Shia's fault. But you don't put Harrison Ford on the back of a motorcycle, okay? That doesn't happen. Like, when they're making the getaway at the university, he's like, hop on, Indy. Indy should, like, kick you, and you will be hanging on to, like, like the kickstand. That's where you should be. Indy will drive. Like,
I never even thought about that, but you are completely right.
Indiana Jones does not ride bitch. I maintain.
No, he doesn't.
Yeah, it's so wrong. So wrong. And have you guys seen that montage? If you go to YouTube and you type in Shia LaBeouf, no, there's a video of somebody cut together all the parts from Transformers and then a couple other movies like, what was that, Rear Window ripoff that he did?
Suburbia. Or Disturbia, that's right.
Yeah. A couple of the Shia movies where they cut together all the times where he says no. And he says it a lot. He goes, oh, no. This will be your calling card. He's just I think he's terrible. Part of it, I think, is the media's fault, too. They were like saying, oh, he's the next Tom Hanks. Really? He's been in 4 movies. Like, he's not the next Tom Hanks.
I just want to see Shia LaBeouf's Philadelphia then at that point.
You just want to see Shia LaBeouf get AIDS.
You said it, not me. That's Tom Brazelton, everyone. Theaterhopper.com.
It's right
please
there.
Don't you can't send the hate mail to Fancy Pants Gangsters.
Well, you know, I don't think anybody saw Tom Hanks in Splash and said, oh, he's the next Jimmy Stewart. You know what I mean? He kind of had to earn that, like, by making good movies and delivering good performances. I think Shia LaBeouf has he has a modicum of potential, but he believes his own hype a little too much. Like, I'm saving movies. Dude, like, you're our new action star template. Like, Schwarzenegger craps bigger than you. Like, what happened to masculinity in America where we're like, yes, this is the guy that will get us through the apocalypse. Like, this is who we want.
It's actually not the first time I've had that conversation kind of come up, and where is the... not just the action hero, but the manly movie star, you know, because he's definitely not. And now we're kind of in a time, and this is probably something for another show too, but just, you know, your, I guess not necessarily just action star, but just a manly kind of role model. I guess that's maybe not the right way to put it, but you really don't have it anymore because everybody's looking like, you know, fucking Dane Cook nowadays. So,
well, you know, you had some potential with Dwayne Johnson and some potential with Vin Diesel. And
both of them Disney ruined.
And they're both models, you know.
Yeah.
Now it's like, what the hell? That's why I'm looking forward to the A-Team. But, you know, that's just me.
I don't think anybody's going to look at Bradley Cooper as the next big action hero.
Yeah, I think so.
Liam Neeson has a better chance. I mean, after
I'm
Taken,
fine with that.
Oh, man. Liam Neeson was like everybody's dad who just came after and just kicked ass. Who wouldn't want that guy to be your dad? They're going to take you. Now, the thing I had with The Rock and Vin Diesel, they were poised for that action hero stardom thing, but they went for the family audience too soon. Like, Schwarzenegger did it with like Kindergarten Cop and Twins.
But he had so many movies already in the books, and same as Stallone, you know, Stop or My Mom Will Shoot. What the fuck?
Estelle Getty was badass in that movie. No. But, you know, they just went for it too soon, and then you can't really go back after that, you know?
Like, has Stallone ever done an actual kids movie, though?
Kindergarten Cop?
Spy Kids. No, Stallone.
He did Spy Kids.
Spy Kids, yeah.
That was
but that was very late. I mean, that was...
Yeah.
When was the first Spy Kids? Like, 96?
Somewhere in there.
Yeah.
Yeah, he did that way, way late. Yeah.
That was supposed to be his comeback.
Could Over the Top be considered a kids movie? I don't know.
It's a family movie.
Nice.
Maybe not.
Oh, God, Spy Kids was 2001. Wow, that's even later than I thought it was.
See, I'm looking, and he didn't, you know, he really didn't do anything for the longest time. Rhinestone? No.
He was in Ants. He was the voice in Ants. That was like 1997 or something like that.
Yeah, no one saw Ants, though.
It's crazy, though. You look at his body of work, and you're like, it's just like a testosterone pill. Like, crazy.
Hey, Tango and Cash was on TV this weekend, and I watched that whole thing. That's just one of those movies.
Not.
That's just one of those movies you just, it doesn't matter what you're doing. You can just sit down and watch that, and right. It's good every time.
Tango and Cash and... Too bad. What was that Keanu Reeves, Patrick Swayze movie? Point Break.
Point Break.
Yeah. Same area. Like,
yeah. Doesn't matter what's going on in your life, you can watch.
You sit down. I gotta watch Keanu Reeves learn to surf.
That's actually a really good excuse to not go to work. I can't come in right now. Tango and Cash is on.
And they say, we understand.
Yeah, that's all right.
I'm upset.
Have fun.
Huh.
Through the years of watching DVD extras and things like that, people, I think, have a rough idea of how a movie is made, you know, from the start of shooting to the end of shooting. But I don't think a lot of people understand the differences and similarities in how a commercial is done. Can you kind of go into, like, what makes a commercial shoot different than a feature film shoot or something like that?
Yeah, things that, you know, there isn't a lot of difference between a commercial, mm-hmm. a 30-second commercial versus a two-hour movie.
Okay.
Other than the obvious things are, you know, time, mm-hmm. money, resources, the amount of people that go into it.
Mm-hmm.
Just like with any movie, just like with any commercial, the first thing you start off is your idea, your story, your mm-hmm. concept. All right. So basically, that's what Ben and I did is we sat down and like, all right, what is it that we, how do we want to tell our story?
Mm-hmm.
So we basically, you know, got together. I imagine every film starts this way. It starts with your writer,
mm-hmm.
you know, sitting on a typewriter and, you know, fade in. You know, interior, bad waitress, cafe, day, all right?
Yeah.
Two men sit at a coffee table, talking shop,
mm-hmm.
right? Same instance happens here. We're kind of like, all right, we want to kind of base our commercial around the Doritos, all right? Ben was the first one to think of the Dorito as like a flying ninja star.
Okay.
Right? So from there, we kind of built it as, all right, why is the flying ninja star coming in? Well, it's coming from somebody who is either a Doritos ninja, you know, dressed head to toe in a ninja outfit.
Mm-hmm.
So we're like, hey, that's perfect. We want to have somebody dressed head to toe in an outfit made completely of Doritos.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's going to be funny.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
And who are they? Who is he attacking? Well, he's attacking somebody who stole his Doritos,
mm-hmm.
right? So here's a couple of unsuspecting dudes, one of them more unsuspecting than the other, in that he's eating the Doritos.
Mm-hmm.
His friend comes along and is like, hey, Doritos. Everybody loves Doritos.
Mm-hmm.
And then he realizes that it's a stolen bag of Doritos from who else? The guy that loves Doritos the most,
mm-hmm.
right? In comes the flying Dorito chip, cut to Tim, who's dressed not only just in a ninja outfit, but a samurai outfit. I hope nobody gets too offended. I think ninjas and samurais, I think they're two totally separate worlds. And
yes.
We've probably offended so many people by having a ninja throw a Dorito chip and wielding
cutting
a knife.
It's very historically inaccurate.
Yeah. We did not do our research enough. But building our story is much similar to building a story in a movie. You know,
mm-hmm.
you know, you start around, you know, and it can start at any point. You know, maybe there is a highlight, the most interesting part of your story, the peak of the story, mm-hmm. and you can kind of build from there. So then once we had our ideas down, you know, we wrote them down. We got behind our typewriter. Nobody does a typewriter anymore.
I was going to ask. I mean, you are from Nebraska, so you never know.
Yeah. Can you see me on one of those old, like, Hunt and Peck typewriters?
Oh, yeah.
With the
I could see it.
We got on our laptops, wrote it out. At first, you know, we had it in an office space. We felt like office humor was still kind of the hip new thing.
Mm-hmm.
But then once we realized that the winners from last year took place in office, we're like, we have to go completely opposite of office. So we were thinking about, you know, where can this take place? Can this take place like on the street, like at a bus stop? You know, can this take place at, you know, we're thinking some type of like workout facility, like a gym, like in a basketball court or something. And then just started building that idea around, oh, maybe these guys are like in a workout area. Mm-hmm. You know, that's kind of funny in itself. These guys are eating chips after they're working out or about to work out.
Yeah.
So then we kind of built it around, you know, built it from there. And then it took a few drafts of us kind of going back and forth of, you know, how does it start off? How do we, you know, where do we come into our commercial? Do they, are they, you know, are they, you know, joking around? Are they telling, I think we had at one point they were telling a joke, and then, you know, the samurai guy, you know, kind of disrupted that. Tim, the Dorito samurai, disrupted that. So it had some, a few evolutions in there. I don't remember exactly how they worked. But then once we, you know, agreed upon our story, it pretty much stuck to that on the day of the shoot.
Yeah.
And there's also a funny, if you want to, I can send you the link for this. A couple days before we shot the commercial, we shot an animatic. Animatic is where it's kind of a term thrown around in the world in that the film industry, and then you go out, you shoot with, you know, whatever camera you can get. You kind of basically do a rough blocking of your scene.
Yeah.
Our scene's pretty simple. Start on a wide shot, go to a two shot, do a close up of, you know, each person, and then do a reaction shots from that.
Yeah.
So it's fairly simple to block. So we got together really early one morning and set up my, you know, I have a Sony Hi8 video camera in my living room. It was super early. We had Mike, who's the kind of the guy who comes in and gets the chip in the neck. Mike Rylander is the actor there. We had him. He was already agreed to do it. He was on board. Steve Hahn was already on board to do the Dorito Samurai. But we didn't have anybody that was going to be the screaming, shaking knees guy.
Yeah.
But we had a couple people in mind. But, so we shot the animatic thinking, all right, this is how we're going to kind of, these are the shots we'll need. This is how we'll block it.
Mm-hmm.
And that morning we did it, and I played the part that I would eventually come to play in the commercial. And Ben loved my scream so much. He was like, dude, you have to be in this commercial. So really, I have to thank Ben for that directing choice of saying and convincing me that my scream was good enough to put into the commercial. So
do you think that, and I don't know how hesitant you are of just making broad sweeping statements like this, but do you think...
I love broad sweeping statements.
Do you think like feature film directors should try to do commercials, or they should, you know, do you think it's like a valuable learning step for people, like, or you know, on the flip side, people that want to get into feature film, do you think they should try to do a commercial or a music video beforehand?
They're both totally different animals.
Okay.
And to say that one can be successful in one and that will relate to the other, tough to say.
Okay.
But I do see, I feel from our perspective is that, you know, it's us trying to, the biggest lesson that we learned from this is not only just selling a product,
mm-hmm.
but selling yourselves.
Mm-hmm.
It's just getting your foot in the door, or, you know, your name on the map.
Yeah.
That in itself is so much more beneficial. Then it's still always going to be, well, what's your next project? What's your next thing that you're going to tackle? What's the next thing that you can sell or you know, create, and it will be successful?
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of the thing that we're, you know, kind of battling now is, you know, keeping the momentum from our, you know, Snack Attack Samurai, keep that going. Now, will our storytellings in short format work in a long format? Remains to be seen. We like to think that it will.
That's the plan.
But that's the plan.
Yeah.
And likewise, I think, you know,
so
we'll see.
I was reading through some of your interviews,
mm-hmm.
That you've done, and you mentioned being a camera assistant in LA.
Yes.
Which you went on to describe as the guy who does the clapper thing.
Yes, yes.
Kind of, if there's any more stereotypical role in like movie-making movies, it's the guy who's doing the clapper.
Absolutely.
And you mentioned that you actually made money at this.
Oh, yeah.
Which is more shocking, I think, than the fact that you actually were a guy that did this. That seems like one of those things where it's like they give to the kid just off the boat.
Yeah.
In exchange for letting him sleep in the studio. Or
right,
something like that.
Yeah. It's surprising. Shortly after film school, and even during film school, I started working in the film industry as a camera assistant.
Mm-hmm.
And it's amazing. There's a whole union based on camera assistants and camera operators and director of photographies, and they're all kind of in the same family.
Okay.
But out in LA, and even here in the Midwest, Chicago, Minneapolis, and even on New York, there's a whole union of camera assistants, and they're, you know, they work in TV shows, mm-hmm. work in full big budget full length feature films, music videos. And so shortly after film school, I moved out to LA, started working as a camera assistant, you know, at first loading, you know, magazines of film, and then working your way up into, you know, slating is the clapping part of that, take one, take two, and all that stuff. And then it's very specialized. So
yeah, I was gonna say,
you know, you start off as like a camera intern, mm-hmm. and then you work up into kind of a camera PA role, in which you're kind of, you know, learning the ropes, and then you start becoming a film loader, which I started doing here in Minneapolis. Joined the union, moved out to LA, started working as a second assistant, which is a maybe all these terms, I'm kind of geeking off on the terms.
Yeah, I'm
here,
fascinated by this stuff, so it's like, so it's cool with me.
So yeah, so they started working as a camera assistant, and then was working almost every day out in LA. But it's a very, you know, think of it as an army. You are, you know, one person. You have one specific role, and that without your one part, you know, the whole army kind of fails, or the whole, I guess, like, I don't know, I'm not doing a very good job of relating it to army terms, but it's
this show's called The Film Army, and it's a really ham-handed metaphor anyway, so it's fine.
Everybody has their specific role, mm-hmm. and in the camera department, everybody has their specific role, and without those, you know, people playing their parts, you know, then the whole thing kind of comes to a grinding halt.
Mm-hmm.
But I quickly realized that, you know, people do this as a career.
Yeah.
Which was something I hadn't known. You know, I thought maybe I'd do this for a little bit, and then, you know, somebody would give me an opportunity to direct a movie.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, no, not really. In LA, once you're known as, you know, a camera assistant, you only get called for,
really,
you know, assistant camera work. So to break away from that, I moved back to Minneapolis to work on a movie as a camera assistant. But it was a Coen Brothers movie, so I thought, hey, this is a great opportunity to work with some of who are my favorite storytellers, writers, directors are the Coen Brothers.
Yeah.
And also, one of the best cinematographers still working at the time is Roger Deakins.
Yeah.
To get to work in his department and just get that firsthand.
He's done all the Coen Brothers movies, right?
He's done the majority of them.
Okay.
I think since Fargo.
Okay.
He did do the Burn After Reading. I think he was working on, like, the story of Jesse James, or the Jesse James movie at the time.
Oh, yeah. By the Coward such and such. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah, yeah.
Which is a beautifully shot movie.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people couldn't get into it because they're hoping it would be more of a Western about Jesse James.
Yeah.
But, gosh, one of my favorite visually mm-hmm. beautiful movies.
Yeah. I've not seen it, I will admit, but I've heard good things about it.
Yeah.
So.
But Roger Deakins, you know, probably one of the best cinematographers working at the time. I thought, hey, this is a great opportunity just to have work in his department and work not with the Coen Brothers, but, you know, work in the same, you know,
universe
as they are. So,
interested in a particular genre, or, you know, more drama, or you go the opposite route, do like another Kabuki Man movie or something like that. Like,
yeah.
What would you want to do? Would you like, or is it just whatever good project shows up?
See, that's it. I mean, it's easy to say we'd love to do like a comedy, mm-hmm. or it's easy to say we'd love to do kind of like a psychological Coen Brother thriller,
mm-hmm.
but until we have it down in on paper and we're both happy with it in a script form and we think that this will be good, mm-hmm. not until we reach that point can we say this is our next project. As it is, I feel like we've got ideas cooking all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But the hardest part about writing, and I think, you know, being a creative force is, and just writing, is just sitting down at a table and just getting it done. And if you know, anybody's listening out there, you'll know that for a writer, it's their hardest thing is just putting their ass in the chair. And it's like, just on a day-to-day basis.
As a writer, yes, I'm agreeing with him.
It's just getting it done.
Yep.
And then until you get it done, can you say, is this going to be good?
Mm-hmm.
I feel like we have multiple stories to choose from. The Doritos thing isn't the last time you've heard of us, but until we get, you know, a good script on paper, it's hard to say what it'll be. Thank you.
lot of time.
Welcome to the Box Office Poison DVD feature here on the Film Army Netcast. I'm your host, as always, Nathan Hall. Now, without further ado, 2002's Ballistic, X versus Sever.
You saw her die. You saw an explosion.
We went to a funeral.
You saw a closed casket.
You waited 7 years to tell me this.
FBI agent Jonathan, or Jeremy, or Jeremiah, or nobody really sure, X, is played by Antonio Banderas. X learns that his most dangerous enemies are the friends that he's double-crossed, and he quits shaving. Agent Sever, played by Lucy Liu, with wardrobe by Jigsaw, is a rogue agent of the DIA. This agency, one can only naturally assume, is the result of a typographical error by either Drug Enforcement or Central Intelligence. Together, they must put aside their differences to defeat a micro-device that can be injected into victims in order to kill them at will. Now, I'm no scientist, but I gather that this is similar to nanobot technology in some respects, sort of like an iPod Nano Assassin. It's definitely small and tiny, we know that much.
We don't have much to go on. Someone's developed a micro-device. The perfect assassin. Injectable, lies in wait inside its victim. One touch of a button, you can give a head of state a heart attack.
It's not so much that the plot has holes, it's that the holes have plots. For starters, the FBI's headquarters have been mysteriously relocated to the neo-film noir capital of the world, the Vancouver Public Library. Considering that the director of the cinematic abortion spells his name Chaos with a K, I would expect nothing less. And it should be noted that the story is based loosely on a video game that ripped off Doom and Castle Wolfenstein, so there's that as well. If neither the director nor both stars can even claim English as their first language, the only thing that you can't get lost in translation is therefore a train yard explosion. It's kind of like your excitable little 10-year-old brother trying to tell you all about The Matrix and Once Upon a Time in China, but keeps mixing up the two.
Sever? Sever? How's Michael?
Fine. He's a good boy. But he misses his mother.
I want him back.
You mean you want what he's carrying?
He could die if we don't get it out in time.
I didn't put it in him, you did. Tell that to your wife.
What do you want?
Your life for Michael's.
It didn't have to come to this, ever.
Well, now it has.
I do appreciate the cynical honesty of giving the public exactly what they want. After all, action fans care about plot and coherent storytelling about as much as porn fans do. Now, do you prefer to watch your friends play video games at parties rather than try to make conversation with the opposite sex? Do you enjoy four-on-the-floor techno, nightclub arcades with inflated cover charges, pleather pants, excessive hair gel, and/or masculine women? Then have I got a movie for you. Or let's just say that you hate boxcars a lot. Man, I sure hope some Canadian railroad got a huge tax write-off for all of this. Highlights of the film include Curtis from 24 and Ray Park from X-Men and Star Wars as what I assume is a British federal agent with a former Cockney soccer hooligan accent. And let's not forget Greg Henry as dapper power and profit broker Robert Gant. In full-on comic book villain self-parody mode, Gant kills his henchman by handing him a gun that shoots backwards. By the way, does anyone know if that still legally counts as suicide or not? I bet a Canadian judge could go either way on that technicality.
Good evening, Mrs. Gant.
What does my husband want now?
His plans changed. He's now available to spend time with Michael.
Michael just came home.
He's expecting his son, ma'am.
Hello, it's Vin. I need to speak to Gant.
Yeah.
Robert, what are you doing? He flew all the way to Europe and five
Daddy?
Days later you sent him home?
Come on, Michael. Daddy's waiting. Come on.
He'll be fine,
Bye,
ma'am.
Mommy!
Robert, you bastard. This wasn't our agreement.
Oh. So many unanswered questions. At least let Lucy Liu talk for more than a minute before you crank up the Electronica satellite station again. If other agents kept the existence of a misplaced spouse from X for 7 years, does that make him the worst secret agent ever, Or was it just that their marriage really wasn't that strong in the first place? If the screenwriter also did Halloween 4 and Left Behind, and this film lost $50 million, is it grossly unfair or poetically appropriate that he's currently working on the new Tekken script? Did a boxcar murder Chaos's father, and that's why he's sworn a blood oath against the railroad industry? Isn't poison way cheaper than robot hitmen? And most importantly, how did two Hispanics make a white baby?
Forget this. We'll do it the hard way. I don't have any healthy antidote. Neither is yours.
Spoiler alert! The sharp-dressed bad guy's wife is really Antonio's wife, and the kidnapped child is really Antonio's kid. Actual line. Quote, "He was the only part of you that I had left." Unquote. And that's not all. The DVD's special features include a game of rock, paper, scissors, high kick, punch. If that does not sell it for you people to rocket this title right up to number one on your queue, nothing will. Tune into the Film Army next month to hear me review 2000's Battlefield Earth. This is Nathan Hall reminding you that if you don't have box office poison on your iTunes isn't really on.
And there you have it. Okay, I won't try to do that voice again. But thank you guys very much for listening, as always. We'll have a full show next month. Swear to God, July 1st, you'll have a full-length Film Army. If you want to contribute to the Film Army, you can always check us out at fancymassgangsters.com and just check out the forums. And in the Film Army forum, there's all sorts of details on how you can help out. Or you can just email me at film@fancymassgangsters.com and I can help you out with that as well. As always, check out our Facebook group. We also have a new Twitter feed. Just go to FilmArmyFPG. That's twitter.com/FilmArmyFPG and get all sorts of updates and movie news and all sorts of cool stuff like that. What else is Twitter for, really? So, and again, we are brought to you in part by Netflix. You can sign up for a 2-week free trial. No questions asked. No contracts to sign. Nothing of that sort. Just by going to bit.ly/FPGflix. On behalf of the rest of the Film Army, including Jeff and Jay and Nate and Courtney and Cameron and all the rest, thank you guys again, and we'll see you next month.